Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Pilipinx and Wellness Podcast. This is Cheryl Sampson Ramirez. I am excited to bring to you all episode 9 of season 4. We are talking with Dr. Jacqueline Tolentino, family practice doctor who focuses on both functional medicine, integrative health, and for this episode, both Sheena Katz and Mark King are my co-hosts to talk to Dr. Jacqueline about Hormonal Health 101. Some of the topics in this episode that we cover range from diabetes, perimenopause, menopause, and hormonal health as it relates to both female and male identified individuals. We can't wait to bring you another great episode. Maayong adlaw, welcome to episode 9 of season 4 for the Pilipinx in Wellness podcast. I am one of your hosts for this episode, Cheryl Sampson Ramirez, and my pronouns are she, her, sha. For this episode's audio description, currently I am wearing a blue beanie, red and white framed glasses, silver headphones that lie over my ears. I am wearing a black hoodie and I have blue and black hair in front of a black microphone. And for this episode, I'd like to introduce my co-host. Let's start with Sheena Katz and then Mark King to follow.
Hello, everyone. This is Sheena. My pronouns are she and her. And currently I'm wearing a black top with a denim button-up shirt. My hair is down and I have some gold hoop earrings on. And next up is Mark King.
Hello, everybody. My name is Mark King. I identify as he, him. I am wearing a black and gray shirt, black on the sleeves, shoulder in the sleeves. I am bald. I have salt and pepper goatee. I got a whiteboard to the right of me and then some Panay Warriors painted in the back that are hanging from my wall there.
So following our last episode, Dying with Dignity, with Michelle Mondia and Minda Sanchez, this month we will be talking about Hormonal Health 101 with lead physician at Love Life, clinical advisor, speaker, and educator, Dr. Jacqueline Tolentino.
As mentioned in previous episodes, all views discussed are for informational and educational purposes only. It's not meant to be medical advice, nor does it constitute therapy or professional advice. Always consult with your health care practitioner, especially before starting any exercise or new health program, or a qualified mental health professional for your particular condition.
And without further ado, we'd like to welcome to our podcast, Dr. Jacqueline Tolentino. Welcome, Dr. Tolentino, and new mom at that. Congratulations. How's that journey going for you?
Oh my gosh, you know, it's thank you. I'm really excited to be here. It's quite the journey. I am a new mama in her early 40s, and this is my first baby. You can only imagine. I am a little sleep deprived, but I'm doing my best.
We're so thankful for having you here amidst the new circumstances.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
So we typically like to open our episodes with knowing where our guests are from, where are both sides of your families, where your families are from, and where you are currently streaming right now.
Yeah, thanks. I'm in Los Angeles, California, currently streaming. My mom is from San Carlos City, Pangasinan, and my dad is from Cabanatuan City, Nueva Ecija.
Let's start with understanding your profession a bit more. You are a functional medicine doctor, correct?
I am. I'm a board certified family medicine doctor and I practice functional medicine. So, you know, if we want to just, you know, give you a little bit of an explanation around that, family medicine really focuses on all conditions for ages zero childhood all the way up to senior and adulthood. So I have the honor and the privilege of being able to treat people of all ages. And at the same time, I've leveled up my education to include functional and integrative medicine, where functional medicine really focuses more on the root cause of conditions. So it's, I kind of describe it as putting on your detective hat and really helping people understand why they have certain disease states or what can help support them feeling better. And integrative medicine, if you add a second layer on top of that, it's really focused on integrating alternative healing modalities, Eastern medicine practitioners, and also a more emphasis on lifestyle medicine. So we practice more holistically, we're focused on prevention, and we're focused on root causes of diseases, helping people understand why they get sick.
I was just curious, how do you contain all of that knowledge?
Oh my gosh, I mean,
it's a breadth of work.
And it certainly is. I think what we have to do is, as physicians, number one, I feel like I'm learning every day from my patients. And number two, we always have continuing medical education layered into what you practice and how you learn year over year. So those of us doctors that continue to stay board certified, you've got a level of education for traditional medicine that you continue to maintain. So there's always continuing medical education for that, just to upkeep with new updates and research. And the same holds true for functional integrative medicine. So there is also additional curriculum that's dedicated to it. So that way you're also staying up to date and advancements in that arena. It's quite a lot, but I also love learning. I love to stay on top of things. So in addition to seeing patients, it's certainly up my sleeve. You'd probably catch me reading a book focused on medical education of some kind that inspires me or interests me, in addition to education through conferences and things like that.
You talk about all the alternative medicines that you stay abreast of. Is there a particular influence of alternative medicine that you lean towards or have more interest in?
Yeah. So a lot of the practitioners that we also work with at Love Life do different kinds. You know, we're talking energetic medicine, Ayurveda, and even traditional Chinese medicine and herbal medicine. So a lot of that is really integrated into the care for our patients. So when I practice functional medicine, I'm wearing that hat of helping people understand the root cause of conditions and why they're sick. And we also have these other practitioners that are lending their experience. And together, we're talking about our patient cases. You don't find that anywhere else where doctors are versed in this kind of medicine. And also they're integrating and collaborating with Eastern medicine practitioners to provide this holistic experience for people. And it's something new. You know, you don't really see that. It's exciting that this is where medicine is heading, that we're bridging the gaps between traditional medicine and Western medicine and really focusing in how can we all work together. Because at the end of the day, we all want the same thing. We want to make sure that our patients are feeling good, that they feel that they're cared for, and that there are no stones unturned, that they really are looking at all of the different things that are going on in their bodies.
Wow, that's pretty awesome, because with Western medicine, it's more of like diagnose and then fix the problem, as opposed to traditional. It's more finding the root of what that is so it doesn't reoccur. It definitely feels like there was a gap there for a while.
A huge gap, you know, and I'm very fortunate to practice in this space. And as a traditional doctor and somebody who had experienced that in the past, more and more practitioners are lending into their curiosity. We're literally leaning in and more focused on how can we learn more about people's bodies in a way that's going to help them understand it, that is going to allow them to thrive, that is going to allow them to realize that there's more than one tool in your toolbox to care for people. It's not just prescriptions. We do optimize lifestyle. We focus on stress and sleep and, you know, how you were brought up, where you were raised. We focus on learning about trauma and trauma history. We focus on different diagnostic tests that will help us understand people's bodies better, to look at nutrients, to look at hormone metabolism, to look at the gut microbiome. And it's quite fascinating when you practice in this space, because there's so much to learn about people. And a lot of times they're coming to see me because maybe they felt dismissed by their doctors. Maybe they felt like You know, they were only offered a few solutions that didn't really agree with them. Maybe they didn't want to take the three prescriptions that they were prescribed. Maybe they only had 10 minutes with a doctor, but they were looking for more. They were looking for more time to spend getting to know the full history to understand that better. And some people feel like they just weren't happy with those answers. Maybe there's a little bit of mistrust and misguidance, and they're looking for more support. So grateful to practice in this space and to be able to offer that.
Actually, Dr. Jacqueline, I have a question for you. Just recently, I saw one of my specialists, my medical specialist, and one thing that she mentioned that I was like, what do you mean by that? Well, so she was like, be careful with the quack doctors out there. There's a lot of quack doctors out there. And then they say that in the Philippines, too. I've heard people say, watch out for the quack doctors. Do you ever hear that, like, towards your profession? Or,
I mean,
where's that coming from?
Yeah, I've heard that before.
In the medical community, yeah.
I've heard that before. But first off, Cheryl, when you heard that, what do you think they meant to you? Like, what exactly did that imply?
It sounded very judgmental. It sounded very judgmental when I was receiving that, and then like judgmental, elitist, in a way, arrogant. But also I'm kind of like, or maybe like, are they referring to people on YouTube? Because I think that happens sometimes, like people, or like, I don't know, I guess like lately a lot of people will go on to like WebMD or YouTube, right, to kind of like look up their symptoms, and they get all of these findings, and then they start to spiral. So I didn't actually know what she was referring to, but I was like, why would you say that in my like time with you, you know?
Yeah, I'm sorry you had to experience that. I personally haven't, but have I heard that said to other practitioners? Of course I have. What I think bothers me about the way that medicine has traditionally been practiced is that you don't know what you don't know. And a lot of doctors may feel as though they've learned all there is to know. And maybe for whatever reason, they might not be as open to other ways of healing and other tools in their toolbox. And it can also be a reflection of where they might lack some of that knowledge and experience to open their mind and expand their curiosity. I would welcome that. As a practitioner who used to practice in the very traditional space, I can say that at one point in my career, I felt that way. I felt challenged and threatened by others who practiced in the same space that may have brought a different level of knowledge or a different type of knowledge that I wasn't used to, and it made me feel uncomfortable. And I think that also shapes clinicians, you know, to stay open-minded and stay curious about healing and knowing that there are different ways and there are other tools. But the bottom line is, we know that the medical system is currently broken, that people are not healing in ways that make them feel good, that we feel dismissed by our doctors, traditionally speaking, that doctors are burnt out, that they barely have time for themselves, let alone the time to really offer really great care for people. And I'm sorry that you had to experience that. I think that when people come to me and they ask questions about their health in a way that just kind of brings on curiosity, it implies that they care about their bodies and that they want to know more about what's going on. And unfortunately, a lot of doctors might not have the additional knowledge or may not have that additional training to be able to truly speak to whatever it is they're judging or criticizing. So I would kind of like lean it back and think that that's a little bit of, I agree with you, very judgmental to say. But at the end of the day, if I tell you that functional medicine is about helping people understand the root cause of why they're sick, it sounds like a no-brainer to me. It sounds like we should know why we're getting sick. And if you don't quite know the answers, or you're not clear, or you don't have enough time to talk about it, or maybe you have to see the next patient, whatever the case may be, that's okay. I just need to know that maybe I should be seeking some additional knowledge and information for myself. So that's the best that I can say. And that really sucks that you experienced that, because there is a lot of judgment out there. At the end of the day, I'm not here to pass judgment to other clinicians. I'm just here to tell you what it means to me to practice and why I practice the way I do. And people need to trust their intuition. If something seems off about a comment that's being made by your clinician, you should ask yourself, like, is this somebody that I really want to share more of my health information to? Or is this just a doctor that I might just be seeing for a one-off and they're not my regular doctor? They're not my home base. They're not on my side to really collaborate on my care.
I hear that.
Yeah, I feel like that's a huge thing of where people don't feel like you talk about having your health team, like you can actually construct that or work in collaboration with doctors in that way. But I feel like that is not a practice, because I remember growing up, like I knew my parents' doctor, like he was actually like a family friend, but like we knew each other. It wasn't just something that, oh, you just go see this person and then you're done. But being able to have that opportunity to actually build a relationship so that there's more context of what somebody may be going through, I feel like is a very, it's become a machine and you just go in and out and then that's it. There's no rapport. There's no, and with when there's that, when they lack that rapport, then the trust starts to dissipate.
Yeah. And a lot of people are experiencing that right now, that, you know, mistrust or distrust or whatever you want to call it. But we see it every day. Mm-hmm. You know, I see it in medicine all the time. And I'd argue, too, that practitioners also don't feel good about practicing that way. You know, 15-minute Band-Aid type medicine. They want to be able to provide care for patients, but it's really hard in the system that medicine is in a state of currently. And I think that practices like what Love Life is doing and many others are really just offering a new way to reimagine how you should take care of your body and take care of your health, focus more on prevention, less on reactive medicine, more on preventative medicine, more on how can we make sure that we keep people healthy for as long as we can? How can we educate them in a way that makes them feel good about what they're doing and learning, you know, just really leaning into our curiosity about that. So I do see and feel a paradigm shift where people are again forming those kinds of bonds and relationships with their clinicians and reclaiming and rebuilding that trust. But it's going to take time.
I had a quick question. Did functional medicine start in the U.S. or are there other places in the world where they practice functional medicine more than the U.S.?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, the Institute for Functional Medicine has a lot of education and resources around practitioners across the globe. So approximately when did it start? I'm not quite sure. I want to say this is something that's been around since, you know, the 1980s or 90s, but you can't quote me on that. I do know that since it was focused on why people are sick and the root cause of disease, that immediately attracted me.
Yeah.
You know? So whenever you hear the words like root cause medicine or functional medicine, that this concept or idea that we should learn why people are getting sick and including treatment protocols that lean into that just for me was like, that's what I want to learn. I want to learn that. And I don't know how much you know about my history, but I'm a breast cancer survivor. And so part of my story is that in my early 30s, the oncologist that I was seeing through traditional medicine, she very much was of the opinion that we've got the cancer out. You went through chemo. You went through hormone suppressive medications. You can go back to living your life the way you did. And when she told me that, it made me realize that traditional medicine might not be the only route I want to take when I'm thinking about caring for my body. Because if I went back to the life that I lived, that was the life that got me sick. Mm-hmm. That was the foundation of a body that was not ready to heal, that was focused on cancer, and that's no way to live, right? You have a double mastectomy and you're in your early 30s, and if you go back to living a life that harbored disease, that's also the same life that can also predispose to metastatic cancer in places that are uncurable, like brain or bones or lungs. And that's when I really focused on my education path. I realized that I have to celebrate and honor the best of what traditional medicine was going to offer me, but I also wanted to learn more about my body in a different way. And that's why I chose functional integrative medicine to be that vehicle to do so.
Mm.
And I think I was also asking you if you know of any other countries that where this is like part of their practice, because I'm like, maybe I need to move there. I don't know.
Yeah, it's tough to say if it's like driven by country, but more so, you know, from a philosophy standpoint, finding practitioners across the globe, there's even a center in the Philippines that is actually dedicated to a functional integrative medicine practice. So I know they're there. And, you know, more doctors are also curious. They kind of want to get out of the system, the rat race, the machine, whatever we want to call it. And they want to focus on ways that make them feel really passionate about healthcare again, passionate about caring for people in a way that energizes them rather than, you know, the burnout that we see amongst doctors these days.
That makes sense on why doctors would be more curious these days, like you mentioned. Well, first of all, your parents must have been thrilled when you told them that you were going to be a doctor, but how did you explain to them what functional medicine was? And, you know, we just love to know more about that origin story. How did that conversation go?
Traditionally, my parents would have never, ever thought that I was going to be practicing this way. My mom, she's a microbiologist. She's 82. She's a metastatic breast cancer survivor who's dealing with metastatic disease right now. She probably, and I hate to speak for her, but she probably would have said, absolutely not. I never would have thought you were going to be doing this. Seeing patients virtually, working in a multidimensional healing center like LoveLife amongst all of these other expert practitioners who are collaborating on care. She never would have figured that out. But part of my healing journey from cancer was also teaching her about how there are different ways to think about your body and think about health. And of course, through my breast cancer journey and through her cancer journeys, that was our opportunity to heal together, to talk about how medications might be helping in one way, but they do have side effects. There's other things that, you know, other ways and other tools that we can heal. And it became more of a collaborative kind of conversation where instead of me like looking for the approval of my parents, I just wanted to explain honestly, from my heart, where I wanted my career to go and how differently I wanted to treat people and why I felt that that was important. And my parents were actually really great about celebrating that. Instead of me feeling really worried that they were going to think differently of me, or, you know, I think that it was important that it came from the heart and that it was honest. And if I was willing to take the leap into a career that was going to expand my knowledge and expand my curiosity and help keep me feeling inspired by practicing, that was a no-brainer to just like let your daughter do that. So very thankful for that.
That's incredible, and actually a great segue back to our episode title, which is Hormonal Health 101. So there's so much that comes along with specializing in hormonal health, and we understand that, you know, when you specialize with this, you do it with both male and females. What made you decide to specialize in hormonal health specifically, and are there specific areas that you kind of lean into?
Yeah, good question. I really first got into it within my traditional career. So before living in LA, I practiced in Miami Beach and I was a concierge medical doctor. And in that practice, it was a multi-specialty practice. We had cardiologists, we had an infectious disease doctor, an internal medicine doctor, and even an integrative doctor at that time. And this is about the years like 2013, 2014-ish, around there. When I was in that practice, there was a practitioner who also was like introducing me to the topic of stress and how I really needed to learn about stress. And when you dive into books that were written about stress, you realize that that is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to hormones and hormone health, because the stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline are hormones that we commonly can think about. Like, I have high cortisol, or I'm concerned about my cortisol levels, I'm concerned about my stress hormones. But hormones are chemical messengers and they communicate different actions in the body, and they're coming from many different places. They're not just coming from the adrenal glands, they're coming from the ovaries and testes, they're coming from the brain. We call those also neurotransmitters. They're coming from the pancreas, which also has insulin to help our body regulate blood sugar. And so you realize that when you study one hormone or one type, it has a different effect into all the other hormones, and they all have this symphony, this beautiful symphony in our body of working together. They have their own rhythm that aligns with the circadian rhythm of the sun and the moon. They have a cadence to how they actually elicit different types of responses in the body. And I was fascinated by that. So this was even before getting breast cancer, you know, learning about hormones and getting inspired by that. When I was at that practice, that was really the start of learning about bioidentical hormones and learning how different types of hormones for patients that were in their 40s and 50s and beyond could also support what their symptoms were and also could protect against bone health, could protect with bone health, brain health, and cardiovascular health. So that fascination was like even before I got sick. Then when I got sick and my own breast cancer was driven by hormones and was a hormone positive cancer, that just made me think even further, I need to dive into this. I need to dive into why my body couldn't regulate hormones well. Maybe I wasn't detoxifying as well as they should. Was I on any sort of, you know, birth control that could have also been contributing to my current disease state? So I had to like ask myself a lot more of these questions that were hormonally driven. What you learn in practice is that people of all ages are going through hormonal changes. You know, you think about women that are women and men, right? So we're thinking about puberty. Then you're thinking about in your 20s and 30s. And then you think about how people feel in their 30s and 40s and 50s. We're always going through some sort of like hormonal change. And I realized that people of all ages, no matter what, are going to be able to relate to what I'm talking about. And that was important to me, that I wasn't just targeting it on one specific population, but using that as a tool to help support everyone.
That's so true. It does affect us at all different age ranges. You're absolutely right. And speaking of balancing hormones, we actually received a question, a community question from our IG stories from Josephine from Marietta, California. And she's asking, how can we balance our hormones the week leading up to our period? So that's dreaded PMS time. How do we neutralize things then?
Yeah. So a tough time for a lot of women. And interestingly enough, PMS symptoms were not like people were never meant to have significant pain and bloating and irritability and so on. That, you know, poor sleep, lots of things, cravings, things like that, that they typically get during that premenstrual time. Interestingly enough, we shouldn't be getting those severe types of symptoms. So if you're a person who is having lots of symptoms prior to your menstrual cycle, it's important to talk to your care team about that. You know, talk to your doctors about that. We know that since the hormones are typically declining down in that week leading up to your menstrual cycle, your estrogen and progesterone levels are starting to slow down and become at a lower pace. That within itself, that decline in hormones is also what triggers some of those PMS symptoms. So there's a rhythmic decline in your hormones that happens before you get your period. And that rhythmic decline, depending on how fast it is and the relationship of those hormones to each other, is also what elicits some of the PMS symptoms that people have. Some of the underlying causes and reasons that have to do with it might be nutrients that are deficient in your body. It may also be related to your blood sugar not being regulated well. It can also be related to stress hormones like cortisol, and maybe the adrenal glands aren't outputting hormones in a resilient way. It can also be related to your thyroid. Maybe your thyroid isn't working well, and that is also something that might need to be investigated. Sometimes, you know, when we look at that decline and look at those symptoms, doctors will do additional tests to help us understand that and explain and put on that detective hat to like look into these things that I'm referring to see if those are contributing factors to why people are getting those issues. Another thing that you often think about is the pain, and people complain a lot about the pain during that time of the cycle. There are chemicals called prostaglandins that are also firing, and there's a concentration of them, especially in the uterine area. And so the firing of those prostaglandin chemicals is also what elicits that pain response. Not a lot of people get this information from their doctors to really like talk about it in that way. But what people can do about it, Number one, they can also look into what I've just mentioned about investigating any of those underlying factors that could be contributing to it. And then there are certain things that we can do from a lifestyle perspective to help support that as well. So, generally speaking, what lifestyle things people can do, they can take a look at what their dietary strategies are like at that time of their cycle. They can focus less on those refined carbohydrates and pay attention to how they're eating during that cycle. They can focus on more relaxed forms of exercise instead of doing things that are super vigorous, focusing on things that are calming, things that are easeful in that week before their cycle. And then blood sugar regulation is also a really important thing. So, that's something that we often will help people investigate to see if that's contributing to it and focus on that rest and relaxation. There are certain herbs that can be helpful and certain vitamins that are helpful as well. And people typically have these one-on-one conversations with their doctors to really decide if they should be adding any of those things or not.
Is there like a staple of herbs that you recommend for people to just take on a daily to help regulate some of those hormonal? And I'm sure it's probably different for both men and women, right?
It is. Yeah. So it's different for men and women. And it also depends on what else I'm seeing, right? So if somebody is experiencing these PMS symptoms, I know that there is also some of these hormonal imbalances that are happening within the sex hormones that are contributing to it. But since I mentioned earlier about how all of the hormones are connected, we also have to think about how the decline in sex hormones affects other areas of the body. Like think about mood, for example. When estrogen levels decline in the body, the reason why our brain also has issues from a mood perspective is because that decline in estrogen is also causing your body to produce less serotonin. Serotonin is a hormone, but it's also that neurotransmitter in the brain that helps to support blissful mood.
It has to
regulate how we feel and feeling good. We call it a happy neurotransmitter because it does just that. And so some of the mood swings and irritability that people can experience in that latter half of the cycle before they have their menstrual cycle just has to do with exactly that. The decline in hormones is also contributing to the mood. And what people naturally reach to that also helps to support that serotonin increase, they might be acutely reaching for all the wrong things. Maybe they're going for the junk food, the comfort food, the refined carbs and the sugar when they shouldn't, because those are the things that are also creating more problems in their body. So it's kind of more of a thoughtful conversation and a delicate dance. And we have to recognize that there are labs that can be tested for the different things that I mentioned that could be underlying factors to PMS that contribute to it. So, there's a lot more that we can dive into, but it's just important to know that that decline is also because there are neurotransmitters in the brain that rely on these hormones. And as those hormone levels decline, that's also part of the reason why the mood is a problem.
Hmm.
Yeah. Wow, that was enlightening. I wanted to do an offshoot on that, but I'm going to get there. I wanted to ask you, this is Cheryl coming back in, Dr. Jacqueline. Let's clarify, when it comes to hormonal health, you can vary across genders. So are there hormones that are provided to help an individual transition from female to male, male to female? Are these the types of hormones that you also specialize or have knowledge around?
Yeah, thanks for clarifying, Cheryl. Unfortunately, so the answer is yes. There are specific hormones that are targeted towards that. But the type of medicine that I practice, I don't practice within that space. There are clinicians that are well-versed in that kind of medicine to support people who are interested in transitions, but it's currently not the space that I practice in. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And so when it comes to hormonal health, are there general symptoms that we should be aware of or look out for as we age for both male and female identified individuals? And I'm selfishly asking this at the age of 45. I don't mind saying that publicly on the podcast. Just because I'm like maybe attributing to everything the perimenopause, so all of a sudden there's like this thing, like recently I got increase in anxiety, feeling lightheadedness, missing like your period, fatigue, joint pain. I'm like, okay, so is something happening with my body, or could this be attributed to some of the hormonal imbalances or declines that you're talking about? So, yeah. Yeah, how do we even like begin to know that there might be some imbalances or declines happening in our bodies?
Yeah, good question. And thank you for sharing that. What some of the things that you're experiencing. What you'll find when you think about hormones is some people might just think of the sex hormones. Maybe they're only thinking of estrogen and testosterone. Maybe they're just thinking of sex hormones being like, I have an issue with my libido. But we know that hormones, like I mentioned earlier, it could be your blood sugar being dysregulated. So the dizziness and feeling lightheaded, sometimes that could be from low blood sugar, not regulating properly. Could it also be changes in your weight, in your metabolism? That can also be a symptom too. We know people are concerned about weight gain as we get older. We also know that obesity is a widespread pandemic right now. Could it also be poor sleep, brain fog, poor concentration, issues with memory? Those are also things that can also contribute. So I always think of symptoms as being very widespread, right? And it's tough to pinpoint one particular symptom, but it could be all of the symptoms. Could it be the fatigue? Maybe I notice that I'm cold all the time. Could it be that I've gained 20 pounds in the last, 3 years and I'm not sure why? Maybe this has to do with feeling dizzy, like you mentioned. Maybe I am noticing changes in the rhythmic cycle of my menstrual cycle, and it's not happening every month anymore. And if it's not happening every month, is that a sign that there's something going on? Yeah, right? Things to investigate. So I would encourage people to pay attention to how they feel, what their symptoms are, and talk to their doctor about the constellation, because part of what you do in practice as a clinician, you have to hear about all of these symptoms that are going on in a person right now, but you also have to ask how long it's been happening, when did you start to notice a change in your health? When was the last time you felt really great and things started to decline? When's the last time you had a full physical exam and a full set of blood work done to really understand what else is going on? Maybe your body is deficient in certain nutrients, or there's other signs of prediabetes that haven't been addressed. So it really does take looking at all the things rather than it just being one particular symptom. Sometimes it's a lot of different symptoms, and maybe the doctor hasn't put the pieces together yet to recognize that multiple hormones are being affected.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, usually when we talk about like perimenopause or menopause, I've encountered with my physicians, it's like, well, are you experiencing hot flashes? And I'm like, well, I don't even know what a hot flash would feel like. So I don't know. I mean, I feel shifts in my temperature, but I'm not sweating like maybe like my older female colleagues are, or are you feeling, anxious or depressed? Because, and if you are, then maybe we should look into psychotropic meds,
Yeah. I mean, that's not where my brain doesn't always go there, right? Like whenever I think about anxiety and depression, I'm also thinking about, does this person have enough of the right nutrients in their body? Because nutrients being deficient can also contribute to that. The decline in hormones, I mentioned that when estrogen declines, then the happy hormone serotonin, your body might not be producing enough of that. And so the conversation kind of takes a bit of a turn for some doctors where, like you mentioned, they might just go straight to the meds, but the meds themselves can also create more side effects and more problems. So it's more important that we look into the root causes and treat that. Because if we can focus on the root causes and treat that, then you might not be experiencing the symptoms that you are.
And hair loss is a common one too, right? Across gender.
It is. It is. And I see that a lot for both men and women. And again, another thing that also has multiple causes. So does genetics play a role there? We do know that like male and female pattern baldness, there is some genetic predisposition to that. We also know that if somebody is not getting enough iron in their diet and their body isn't having good storage amounts of ferritin, which is a marker for how your body stores iron, that can also contribute. We do know that stress plays a big role, and we see that a lot for people. They might have like different time periods of shedding where their body goes through a lot of shedding a lot of hair at once, and that might happen a couple times a year. We also know that if the thyroid isn't working well, I mentioned that earlier, that can also contribute to, hair loss. So there's many different causes, and maybe it's not just one.
Yeah, no, I've had colleagues say, or have you tried taking Was it postnatal? Is it, or what are prenatal vitamins to help with that? Or there's like another thing that they sell at Costco that is really popular for hair loss that I'm blanking on. It starts with an M. It's kind of like a Rogaine, but it's not.
Yeah, minoxidil.
Yes, minoxidil. So those are the quick ones that are like, try minoxidil, that'll help. Or try prenatal vitamins. That helped me. So it's like everyone always has like, yeah, their two cents on this topic.
Totally, which is why it's so important to like cut out the noise from everybody else and talk to your doctor, talk to somebody that you trust to really dig into it. Because what might cause hair loss in one person, it's not the same on what causes the hair loss in you. So
Okay.
we can't always go there, you know?
So you're saying there's still a chance, is what you're saying. I have a question for you. As you were sharing this information, what comes up for me is that in this process, there seems like there's a lot of sleuthing that takes place, right? Like you're doing a lot of investigative work. And I feel like for a lot of people, that becomes challenging because that becomes time, that becomes money. And I'm sure like some of these alternative medicines are not even covered by health insurance. So is that something that you experience when working with people, and how do they navigate that? Because I can only imagine like if you're sleuthing and then funds run out, like what do? You know what I mean?
And it sounds like Mark King, you're referring to on the patient side, right? Like the patient experience. Yeah, it's tough because there's a down a balance between finding a clinician, finding a doctor that is going to help you really understand your body in the way that you want to learn it. And then the second is how much of it is supplementation driven by lifestyle, things that are habits that I need to break. What kind of support do I need to do about changing the current way that I'm living? What kind of screening tests have I had done? Some of which is covered by insurance, some of which is not. A lot, we know that many chronic diseases, somewhere upwards of 80%, are driven by lifestyle, driven by how we're eating, what we're putting in our body, what the environment is like where we live, what we're exposed to, the toxins, the endocrine disrupting chemicals, the hormone disrupting chemicals that we're exposed to, what kind of water that we're drinking. Are we exposed to a lot of pollution? Like all of these different things that are also playing a role. And it's not easy for everyone to come to terms with collectively looking at all of those things, but that's part of what I do from a clinical perspective is asking about where people live, asking about how they live, what kind of work they do. Are they sedentary, working at home indoors? Are they outdoors and getting natural sunlight? Are they, shift workers that are working overnight? So it certainly is a lot of sleuthing. But what I will say is that once you learn and know about why your body is doing what it does, and what you can do to help support it in a better way, it's hard to say that you don't want to invest into that, right? People want to invest into learning about these things and getting clear answers as to why they feel the way they do. Because at the end of the day, we all want to thrive, we want to feel great, we want to feel our best, and that's what's most important. So it is a tough thing to come to terms with. And it's not for everybody. Some people are like, no, I feel absolutely fine. I'm great. I do only need to see my doctor once a year and I have zero symptoms. And even then, I still get some patients like that who are still curious about preventing the heart disease that runs in the family, preventing the cancer that their mom or grandparent had, preventing, cardiovascular disease and diabetes and stuff like that. So I still get patients where they are ultimately curious about what they can do to support their bodies. And if there are things that they can do to change the way they live, change the way they eat, change some of that, those unhealthy habits that they have, that they are the ones that want to do it. So, you know, that curiosity kind of like comes with a territory of ripping off the Band-Aid of reactionary medicine and focusing on prevention. And that does require some sleuthing because we are all unique. My body and how it metabolizes things is very different from yours and how it metabolizes things because of everything, because of our environment, how we grew up, where we lived, what we've experienced in life. And it takes a skilled clinician to also honor and recognize that we are all unique. And, you know, in order to really treat somebody, to focus on chronic disease and prevention and longevity and increasing your health span, you have to dig that deep. It can't just be 15-minute medicine seeing you once a year. You're not going to get very far if you don't want to inquire and really learn about people and get to know them in a way, just like what you described, Marking, about, you know, the doctor that you had seen before when you were younger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I love that. It just makes it more like, okay, I'm down to go see my doctor, as opposed to like, I'm just going to go to the doctor and then just get some sort of prescription and then just, boom, I'm out.
Yeah. And traditionally, like, I know that my mom, just as a good example, she felt like medicine was like that for many years. Mm-hmm. Right. Her first cancer was when she was 48. Then it came back again when she was 68. Now she's 82. And for many, many years, you know, I think about how she was treated by doctors. And it was very much, you know, the once a year, the quick prescription, and not really digging deep, not understanding other parts of her body. It was more like, oh, you have this one problem. You have a cough or cold. Boom. Antibiotics.
Right.
Oh, your thyroid's not working well. Okay, I'm sorry that it's not working well. Boom, thyroid medication. Mm-hmm. Right? And just like kind of like tacking it all on. Like cholesterol is high. Here, take the statin.
Yeah.
Not like, okay, there's a family history. You know, what's going on with your diet? How are you eating and nourishing? There's like all of these inquiries, right? These questions that we should be asking to understand people better. Not quite getting to that. So I think, you know, in more ways than one, Sheena, she's celebrated that I'm practicing in a different way. Because it also helps people in a different way. And more people being as curious as they are really taking to these outside the box approaches. So.
Okay. I actually am curious. A lot of healthcare in this country, now speaking, we're recording in the U.S. because we have listeners that are listening from across the globe. A lot of the healthcare that is driven in this country is driven by insurance. Right. So most people will basically go within the limits of their insurance to whatever healthcare they can access based on what their insurance dictates. For other sorts of alternative outlets like East Asian medicine, Ayurveda, integrative medicine, functional medicine, I'm sure many people would like to, you know, listening to this podcast, pursue those routes of medicine. What does that look like? Could that get covered by PPO insurance? Or what is the fee structure of what that would look like? For example, Dr. Jacqueline, you're at Love Life. What would that look like in terms of how someone with or without insurance would be able to access these other means or alternative modes of medicine?
Yeah. And thank you. Really great question. I think what's hard about practicing the way that I do is that it's not recognized and honored by many different insurance companies. There are a few insurance companies that do recognize it. And for some people, it's also an out-of-pocket benefit where they can see a practitioner outside of the insurance arena and still gain some sort of coverage, right? That also requires that you do the extra legwork. You see a practitioner who's outside of the network because you really wanted to see that practitioner, but then you've got to get a super bill. Then you have to submit that to your insurance. Then we have to, like, you know, play the opposite game of you paying up front and seeing if the insurance is going to cover it. It really, it's really disappointing that that's the state of where we're at right now, where insurance doesn't really celebrate or honor this kind of medicine wholly just yet. I know that it's coming, and there are certain practices that do have practitioners that are open-minded, that are, you know, more functional and integrative sound that is covered by insurance, but it's certainly few and far between. So it is a tough battle where we're at right now, because when you say insurance is dictating it, we're still talking about more of that traditional reactionary medicine. And what we're talking about is more preventative medicine, more holistic healing. And it's not quite there yet. But since I am seeing a paradigm shift in not just patients, but practitioners that are more open to practicing this way in this space, I can't wait for insurance to celebrate preventative medicine. It's taking it in this particular way, right? It's taking time, but I can't wait for that to happen. It's not quite here yet in the way that I wish it was more open to people, but that's just where we're at. That's the reality of it. What I will say is that some communities still offer community acupuncture, community healing, community sessions that also reduce the cost. Companies also offer a lot of free education, whether it's on their blogs or platforms or their Instagram. There are companies that are offering that as well. There are a few companies that do offer insurance coverage for this kind of medicine, but again, very few and far between. So it's going to take time. And the more that people raise their hand and say, this is the kind of medicine that I'm looking for, these are the kinds of practitioners that I want to see, and that we raise our hand and we continue to vocalize it to the insurance companies, then the more they're going to turn their head and eventually say, okay, we need to start offering this. So it also takes a little bit of advocacy on our part, both as practitioners and also as patients, to also say that this is what we're looking forward to seeing the insurance start to cover.
What would that look like if someone were to come in and just say, "Hey, Dr. Jacqueline, I listened to your episode on Pilipinx and wellness. I really want to come see you at Love Life. What am I looking at financially when I'm coming in, like for an initial assessment and like labs? Like, what is this fee structure? What might that look like?"
Yeah, so at Love Life, it's currently within a membership model. So people typically pay a fee per month. And there are certain times of the year where, like Thanksgiving, for example, or the holidays, maybe they offer special promotions where you get like, a month free or something like that. But it's typically in a membership model. Now, some practitioners that practice functional integrative medicine, they have their own fee structures that are just on an as-needed basis. And maybe they're only serving as consultants of care, and they're not serving as your primary care doctor. And, sometimes there's a difference between that. So a lot of companies offer a membership type model where people can pay on a monthly basis to support that. Some people are utilizing FSA and HSA from their insurance. So if they do have that kind of coverage and they have FSA and HSA dollars, they can put that towards their physician appointments. So that is something that's offered. Some people will pay up front and get a super bill and submit the super bill to their insurance and talk to the insurance about getting some sort of out-of-network coverage for the physician appointments. So there's a few ways that people kind of get around it with that when it comes to insurance. And it's all dependent. I mean, we all have different kinds of insurances with different premiums and deductibles. So it's important to like call them and check with them about that, so at least you know what you're getting into.
And sorry, can I ask and clarify, what is the membership at cost at Love Life?
Yeah, there's different ones. So if somebody is using the facility itself, and I'd love for you guys to come and visit us. So Love Life has many different membership models. So we have a fitness and recovery model. We also have the medical membership. So some people are just interested in just seeing the clinicians and the care team. There is also an optimized membership where people have access to this beautiful 45,000 square foot facility that offers the best of recovery and fitness and nourishing food and expert clinicians under the roof and the medical visits. And that's more of an all-inclusive package. And there's also unlimited memberships that offer higher level concierge care in terms of having unlimited access to not only the facility, but also the care team. All different models. The fitness and recovery of the facility alone is roughly, I think, about $300, $350 a month. And the packages that also combine the expert care team and my care are typically running around $750 a month.
Got it. Okay. Now, if we wanted to supplement our current care with something like Love Life, and let's go back to the topic of aging, right?
What kinds of questions should we ask our primary care physicians or our specialists around this topic of aging? So sometimes going back to like, if some of us like are going through our insurance and getting healthcare, right? Sometimes when you mention a certain thing, that might be a nod to, oh, you know, this is going to be, maybe we could look into this lab, right? Or maybe this would be like a key signal to like prescribe this medication. So when we're, again, if we're going on our routine annual visits, are there certain like markers that we should like, or labs that we should request from our specialists or our primary care physicians when we're doing our annuals?
Yeah, when you're referring to the annual exam, that typical like once yearly exam, right?
Yeah.
You know, normally there are a set of labs that primary care doctors will obtain, but not all doctors practice the same way. And not all doctors are inclusive of like an abundant amount of labs that they feel like are really important to people. But I'll give you a good example. When people come to see me after seeing a primary care doctor, they may have only checked 20% of the markers that I typically look at when I see a person for the first time. 20%. So that means they might just be checking liver and kidney function, a blood count, and maybe, if you're lucky, a vitamin D. And maybe that's it. And maybe cholesterol. But there are other practitioners that take it a little bit further. And we're looking at hormone levels. We're looking at many different micronutrients, not just vitamin D. We're looking at B vitamins. We're looking at iron. We want to look at your magnesium and zinc levels. We want to look at folate. We want to look at ferritin, how your body stores iron. Maybe we're also looking at the pathways of hormones. We're looking at the thyroid, the way that the signal is from the brain to the thyroid gland, and how the gland itself is outputting hormones to the rest of your body. So I think what we've done at Lovelike is we've really expanded the panel of blood work to make sure that we're covering the wide umbrella of nutrients, hormones, cardiovascular health, blood sugar, et cetera, so that we've covered a lot of the major issues there. When people go to the doctor to get their cholesterol checked, they might just be looking at the total cholesterol, the HDL, LDL, and triglycerides, and that's it. But in practice, we see that there are secondary cardiovascular markers that we can look at Quest or LabCorp, and so we test those. We look at those markers because we also know that that also helps us make decisions on treatment courses and people's care. You can check your level of omega-3s in your body. And people didn't know that they can test for that. They're like, I had no idea that I can, you know, get lab work done to look at the levels of omega-3s. But why would that be important? Because omega-3s are essential fatty acids that our body can't make. And we typically get them from fish as one of our main sources. But they're so beneficial. They're beneficial for cardiovascular support. They're beneficial for brain health. They're beneficial in the cancer world for cancer prevention. They help with blood flow and circulation. It helps with inflammation in the body. So why not understand if your body needs more of that? And I think that's also an important thing to make is that, you know, if we want to take a good look at what's going on in people's bodies, we need to take it to that level. Let's test what we can when it comes to a comprehensive panel of blood work that's not just focused on the 20% of markers, but really does stretch to take a look at everything.
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about hormones and women's health. For men, what are some like, you know, because men, we testosterone, that's all we know. Right. Like, so what is it that we as men need to start paying attention to when you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s? What are the symptoms of imbalanced hormones, or, you know, what are some of the things that we should pay attention to?
Yeah, good question, Mark King. And of course, we want to make sure that we're all not just talking about women, that we're talking about men, too. What I commonly see is that for guys in their 30s, 40s and 50s, metabolic health is truly important, how your body metabolizes things. So people should pay attention to weight. They should pay attention to family history of diabetes, cardiovascular conditions, and cancer. They should pay attention to blood sugar not being regulated properly, insulin resistance being also a driver of some of that. So that the weight gain is probably one of the more common things that I'll see in men of that age group. The second has to do with testosterone, libido, and muscle mass. If they're not holding on to enough muscle, if exercise isn't optimized, if they're not reaching their goals with their weight, another common thing that I'll see. So it's not always just the libido question when it comes to testosterone. It's also that as well. Another thing that I'll see is poor sleep, fatigue, and being super tired all the time, not feeling motivated. I see a lot of people for that. And sometimes it's all of the symptoms together. I can't sleep. I'm really tired throughout the day. I've got brain fog and I can't concentrate. I'm gaining weight faster than I was. And my blood sugar is off. And I think that my cholesterol might be a problem. Oh, by the way, I have a family history of diabetes. And my dad died of a heart attack in his 50s. And my brother was just diagnosed with, you know, X condition and is now taking meds. So I see that like every day, that kind of population or that kind of person. It does take a level of inquiry, you know, like we have to think about it in our 30s, 40s, and 50s. A lot of the chronic diseases that people develop, like diabetes and even cancer and even high cholesterol and cardiovascular disease, a lot of these things didn't just all of a sudden start when you're 50 or 60 or 70. It actually started in your 30s, 40s, and 50s when your body was already starting to have some of these changes and you may not have addressed it or didn't even know.
Yeah, so that it really, it's not just testosterone levels, it's other things that you get to, at least for, it's great because now we get to create awareness. It's not just about T levels. Guys, come on, let's go.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, another interesting thing that a lot of guys find to be like, wow, I didn't know, has to do with how your body metabolizes even testosterone. Because when your body makes testosterone, some of that testosterone is even converting into estrogen. Let me say that again. If you have testosterone, some people, like your body converts some of that testosterone into estrogen. As it converts it into estrogen, if your body does not detoxify estrogen well, meaning you don't have great gut health, and maybe your liver isn't detoxifying the way that it should, that estrogen gets recirculated into the body. What happens when our body recirculates estrogen? We have saturated receptors for estrogen in fatty areas. In women, this is the breasts. In men, we'll often see it in the belly section.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So oftentimes when I'm concerned about hormones, I'm concerned about blood sugar being regulated properly. I'm also concerned about the sex hormones and somebody aromatizing into estrogen. Maybe the testosterone is doing too much of that, and concerned about how well this person's body is able to detoxify hormones, which mainly is happening through all the mechanisms we know about detoxification. How you breathe, how you sweat, how good are your bowel movements, how good is that digestive tract, making sure that it's getting things out, and then, of course, making sure that the kidneys are working really well to filter things.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's great information. There you go, guys. Pay attention.
It's not just testosterone. Look at the adrenals. Look at the thyroid. Look at how your blood sugar is being regulated. You know, talk to your doctor about all of these symptoms or things that you're concerned about. Even if you don't have any symptoms, but you're concerned about diseases and family history and things that run in the family over time, it's important to get checked out. Another thing we want to make sure that people are doing is preventative screenings are there for a reason. You know, Cheryl, we talked about colon cancer and colon screening. It used to be at age 50 that everybody at around age 50 was going to get a colonoscopy, and that's now been dialed all the way back to age 45. And the reason why is because more and more younger people were also starting to get colon cancer, and we recognize that we can screen them earlier. Breasts, when it comes to mammograms, you know, that again, that age was a lot higher. Now it's dialed back to 40, and for some women, even sooner than that, depending on family history and personal risk factors. So making sure that you're getting checked up and checked out, super important. And a lot of people, especially during the pandemic, they may have missed a couple of years of seeing their doctor and getting checked out. But it's important to just, you know, step back and say, when was the last time I saw a doctor? What kind of symptoms do I have? What are my goals with my health? How far do I want to take this? And, you know, making sure that you see a practitioner who's going to help you address all of those things.
I think it's great that you just remind people people to take advantage of those screenings, because I'm like old school mentality. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, like if I don't feel anything, then I'm not going to the doctor necessarily. But, you know, you being able to just reemphasize for folks, like, take advantage of these screenings, because it is important, especially as we age, as we get older.
Yeah. You know, and sometimes people are like, I don't know what I need to get done. What screenings do I need to do? And again, it's always based off of age, personal history, family history, all things that a clinician is going to ask to help you decide what you need to get done. As a follow-up, we typically recommend that patients have skin screenings. So they typically get what you call mole mapping or skin exam by a dermatologist at least every couple of years. People typically who have eye issues typically will see an optometrist, an eye doctor, you know, once a year. And dental cleanings, super important. And people typically should go 2 to 3 times per year, depending on what the findings are. And the dentist typically does that. So some of these little things that are like upkeep for prevention and for making sure that you get checked out, it's for a reason.
Wow. No, I'm so judging myself right now. So judging myself after you just ran off about list of all those. It's like, oh, wow, I haven't done that. I haven't done that. I haven't done that.
Well, I mean, you know, part of this is learning for everybody. Yeah. And for some people, it's just also just reminding yourself to get checked up and talk to your doctor about what screenings should you be doing for your age and with your medical history and, you know, your family history, and just starting a conversation, just having that conversation. That's the first step.
I love them. That's great stuff. Thank you for that.
Yeah, but I would say my next question I want to ask you is about soy and estrogen.
Ah,
soy, yeah. Estrogen.
Soy. That's a good question.
That's a really good question, because I have questions about that too. That I mean, I have a lot of misinformation about it, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a tough one. You know, there's always been like back and forth and back and forth when it comes to soy. You know, I typically err on the side of like non-GMO soy. And then also you have to think about like how much people are eating. When somebody asks a question like, is soy bad for me? Then you're like, well, how much soy are you eating? Are you having like 4 cartons a day? Or are you talking about like the non-GMO soy that you may have bought at the grocery store that, you know, you're having once every 2 weeks? What we learn when it comes to soy is that there are things called phytoestrogens and things called xenoestrogens. So there's good estrogens that are actually really helpful for the body that act like it. And then there are some that are harmful to the body that act like it. And so xenoestrogens are typically chemicals that also disrupt the hormone system. So there are different kinds of toxic chemicals that are considered xenoestrogens. And then there's phytoestrogens that are beneficial. So you've got good estrogens, you've got ones that mimic estrogen in a bad way. And I think that's where like the jury is still kind of out. Though, you know, how much of what people are using or eating kind of like helps us understand that better. But I have yet to find somebody who has said, I'm eating 4 cartons of, you know, tofu from the grocery store every day. Is that a problem for me? It's more like, you know, just in general, if you're having a little bit of it and it's a non-GMO soy, and it's likely not going to be harmful in terms of that. So
I think, and I'm just going to guess, because at least for me, it's the same thing. But a lot of the questions is when people give up dairy and switch to soy, how much is too much? Because I don't think, same with me. I don't know a whole lot of people that are eating a lot of tofu, but I'm lactose intolerant. So I find the different milks. I go from soy to almond to oat. So that's where I heard it too, is be careful how much soy milk you drink, is the estrogen and a lot of misinformation.
Yeah. I mean, normally, and I hate to be everybody's doctor on here, so I think it's always important to bring it up to your doctor and be like, how much am I drinking or eating? And if I am drinking or eating this much, is it problematic for me? Because how you process it and how your body responds to different kinds, it might not be the same for the next person. And maybe they're eating soy-rich foods for a different reason. entirely different reason than the reason why you are.
Right.
Normally, that rotation where you're also rotating through some of the alternatives is also healthy for the gut to also like not always just be eating the same thing all the time, but to introduce a rotation there. Mm. So got to think about that, too.
After surviving cancer, how much did your lifestyle change? Because you were saying you started to realize for yourself, like, the stuff that the environment or whatever it was part of the cause of what you'd experienced. So in being able to recognize that and sleuthing all the different potential causes of that, like, how much did that, I'm sure that changed a lot.
Huge, Mark King. Like, my entire life got flipped upside down. In a good way, mm-hmm. in a healing way, in a therapeutic way. I was, and I'll help you picture this. At the time that I was diagnosed, I just turned 33. Mm-hmm. I was a concierge doctor seeing 20 patients a day, 5 days a week.
Dang. And that's stress.
Now you're learning to, like, you know, start to put some of these clues together, right? So it was 20 patients a day, 5 days a week. Working the holidays, working the weekends, little time, little break for me. And you can imagine that self-care was down to a minimum. What you find out when you learn about cancer is that in order for a mass to be a palpable mass that you can find in or on someone's body or even on imaging, the first cancer cell that was created that went wrong, typically we're talking like 5 to 10 years. Before this individual has a palpable mass or a mass that can be found on imaging. So what that means is when I inquire about myself getting cancer when I was 33, that I had to think about my lifestyle and, you know, my environment in the 10 years before I actually got sick. So now you're dialing it all the way back to 23-year-old Jacqueline. And when you dial it back that far, I was dealing with a lot. I was way overweight. I weighed roughly 180 pounds at that point in time. I'm 5'3". I was also starting medical school. I was also super stressed out. I also had underlying trauma from childhood that was not dealt with. And we all know what happens when you have underlying trauma. And again, what that does to the body, it also creates an inflammatory response, doesn't allow your body to heal. Also upregulates your nervous system. I was likely deficient in a lot of nutrients. I was also, from a hormonal standpoint, my hormones were off the charts, all problematic. I was also on birth control for several years, 14 years or so. And so all of that leading up to the cancer, I have to look back at all of those things in the 10 years prior, that kind of like that multitude of so many different points in time. And if you make a list of all of those things, it kind of goes back to my lifestyle and how I was living it, thinking about my family history. And, you know, even though my cancer was not genetically found to be aligned with my mom, we both were on some form of birth control in our lives for several years. And I have to think about that and what the side effects and repercussions were of that. What I learned, you asked about how my life changed. It changed significantly because when you go through chemo and you drop all the way down to 108 pounds, you know, from back all the way up high at 180, and then you drop all the way down, you lose your hair, you're really in a vulnerable state, really vulnerable state, to the point where you really do focus on how can I create health? How can I create healing? How can I allow my body to recognize that it needs more support? And when I looked into how I wanted to practice, that's when I learned about functional integrative medicine, because I was looking for another way to heal. When your traditional doctor tells you you can go back to living your life the way you did before you got sick, you realize, like, if I went back to that life, I might not be here 5 years down the road, you know? So when you kind of do a lot of digging into alternative healing, you start, as a clinician, I started to come across functional integrative medicine, and that's really what sparked the interest. What I learned when I started to dig deeper into the education was that
My body was deficient in nutrients.
That chemo and hormone suppressive medications certainly did a number on my gut. The ecosystem of bacteria that lives in your gut microbiome, it has its own balance. And if it doesn't reach a level of homeostasis and balance and it's disrupted, it creates inflammation. It also recirculates toxins, recirculates estrogen, and creates problems. I learned that my body was clearly inflamed, that my immune system, since we know that the immune system is also lies in the digestive tract of the gut, my immune system was downregulated from the cancer. That's something that I needed to strengthen with whole nourishing foods. I also learned that I needed to deal with my stress in a better way. And not everybody handles stress the same way, but the resiliency for me, I needed to, especially since I also had that childhood trauma history that also played a role in how my body heals. So once I kind of dug into that inquiry, I was like, oh my gosh. You know, I think about the stressed out Jacqueline who is 33, seeing 100 people a week, working on the weekends, burning the candle at both ends, barely taking care of herself. And I realized that that's what I needed to change. So I could no longer practice that kind of medicine anymore. And I needed to practice in a way that was going to allow me safe boundaries and allow me to thrive and allow me to feel really good about how I see people and, you know, care for others. So it was a 180 degrees, Marking. 180 degree flip.
I can only imagine. I have an emotional intelligence background. And one of the big things that I believe is that the stresses that we have, they are just emotional inflammations. And if they're not dealt with, or not dealt is not the right word, but when those, if you don't address those emotions, those energetic inflammations become physical inflammations and they can express themselves as hives, heart attacks.
Yes.
Stroke, whatever. So that's, and being able to dig deep and go back into childhood and to identify that and do any kind of healing work around that really helps to alleviate a lot of those stress levels. Are you a meditator as well?
Yes. Yeah. That was something that wasn't part of my healing journey before. Mm-hmm. But of course, post-cancer, when you are faced with the cancer the way that I was faced, especially with my mom, right? She had a history of having it when she was 48 and 68. You open your heart to all different kinds of healing modalities. And that also means recognizing that your nervous system, for many years, if not my whole life, you know, needed more tending to, needed more support. I often get patients that'll mention, I have chronic low-grade anxiety every day, all the time. It's always there. And those are the same patients that are also experiencing symptoms that have signs of inflammation that do need to find outlets and ways to help process how that nervous system is always upregulated to help calm down the body, to create resiliency so that it allow you to truly heal. And, you know, meditation is incredible for that.
As you know, Dr. Jacqueline,
I remember having such difficulty with it early on, and it took time. I took an entire year off post-cancer. You know, I quit that job. I focused on my education. I was living in this beautiful healing place in Miami Beach that was really just dedicated to self-care. And it is hard, Marking, to come to terms with what you need to do in order to, you know, really rip off the Band-Aid on trauma and figure out what you need to do to heal.
Yeah.
It is not easy for everybody to recognize what effect different kinds of trauma has on your body. But I 100% agree with you. It manifests through symptoms. It manifests in our tissues. You always hear that. The issue is in your tissues. It manifests in all different ways physically, right? And those physical symptoms are also the sign of underlying there is something there that needs to tend to. Not every clinician is going to approach it that way, but I do.
It's epigenetics,
because
right?
I experienced it.
Right.
So
it's epigenetics, right?
Yep.
Are you familiar with the Dr. Joe Dispenza?
Of course. Yes.
Okay, good.
Very familiar. Incredible. I mean, fascinating story too for him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you think about how powerful our mind is, in terms of what it can do to support the healing journey, I always, especially in my cancer journey, I really loved those books that really focus on that because it's inspiring. You know that there are things that, you know, no one can quite explain. And some people have an explanation and others, they say these are miracles or these are things that just happened. But however you approach it, I find inspiration in all of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's very inspiring for so many of us that, you know, if anybody is listening, you should consider looking into a lot of his work.
A lot of his work. I mean, his stuff is really amazing. What I like about Joe Dispenza is that he puts the science into the woo-woo. You know what I mean? Like, he talks about meditation in a sense of it being a very, like, everybody should have that in their practice. And it's not just this hippy-dippy, like, we're all going to hang out and just om together. But he provides actual studies and the science behind it and shows the benefits. And it's amazing. I was lucky enough to go to two of his workshops.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And huge value.
Yeah. And you know what's funny is that some people feel as though meditation has to be what you describe, right? Like sitting cross-legged in a room saying, oh, it doesn't always have to be that way. You'd be surprised that, like, me just folding Koa's clothes, my son, he's only 4 months old, right? Like, sitting there on a Sunday, just folding his clothes, listening to a chill podcast or listening to music, that might be meditative for me. That might put me in that same space of calm and safety and peace that I need to just help continue to support my nervous system. Maybe it's the way that I wash dishes or the way that I put on my skincare or, you know, like how you wind down for bed, something like a foot rub and just doing that, but also doing it in an intentional way. The way that people think of when they think of meditation doesn't always have to be that, you know, stereotypical way. Yeah. It doesn't. It could be totally something that's so unique to you.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's, I think that's also a great thing to point out is that, you know, to put yourself in that space of safety, peace, calm, that's what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
The world is as hectic and crazy as it is, you know?
Yeah.
So, We can only control so much.
Yeah.
Or not control any of it at all.
Yeah. I mean, having that meditation practice just allows you to quell the noises.
Yep. Yeah.
And that's
and most people, that vagal tone and like that nervous system, that sympathetic nervous system that is always up, it's like that for a majority of us, that the environment that we're in, the people that we're exposed to, our work and our stress, finances, relationships, family, all the things, helps to kind of like upregulate that, calming it down, finding peace in your day, finding that space to just tap into what you need, you know, tapping into source. We can't stress enough. I think I feel like everybody in here, we all recognize that it's important, right? On a daily basis, because time and time again, over and over again, what happens to the body that is under a constant state of low-grade inflammation?
Yep.
It starts to exacerbate with all of these symptoms. It will sabotage your healing journey from whatever it is you're dealing with.
Yeah, if you know how to look at it, you will see how much of our lives we live in fear and just reaction in a reactionary state. The reason why I have a job is because I could put food on my plate, so I have money to buy a house. That's fear based. You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
And if we don't look at it that way, but if we start to look at it that way, and start to understand how much of our lives in our daily that we are operating from fear, that adds to that low grade inflammation. And if there's like high level stress, that just inflammation just gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
It behooves us to really understand the lifestyle at a deeper level.
100%.
Yeah.
It takes that level of self-inquiry,
mm-hmm.
you know, like wanting to be curious and take a step back, reflecting on how, you know, how you're living your life, where you think some of the hangups are. And for people who need that additional support, you know, finding a practitioner or a care team that feels really good, that feels supportive, that you feel confident in, that you feel inspired by, super important.
I like that. I like carotene. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So being that we are Philippine X in wellness, what are the most common medical conditions that you see related to hormonal health within our community, coming from a functional medicine perspective?
Yeah. Thank you. Really good question. So some of the most common conditions that I'll see that are related to our community specifically, blood sugar being dysregulated and early signs of that, you know, you think of diabetes, pre-diabetes, and even before that, some signs of insulin resistance. I also see obesity. I also see cholesterol issues. And sometimes people have more than one or multiple of these. Hormonally, I'll also see thyroid conditions, right? We also know that sleep as a disorder is also a contribution from a hormonal perspective as well. So those are some of the more common things that you'll see. I also see some, interestingly enough, a lot of people really struggling with fertility, struggling with keeping up those testosterone levels, Marking, that you had mentioned earlier, right? Helping to maintain that or, you know, getting the levels to a good place where they feel good. And, you know, maybe they're having issues with libido or muscle mass or that, you know, extra layer of fat around the midsection, et cetera. So some of those are like the more common ones. Blood sugar is always at the top of my list because when I think about our community, we are struggling with obesity, cardiovascular disease, diabetes. That is of utmost importance. So there is a level of education that goes into making sure that people understand what contributes to these disease states and what applies to you and how you live your life, right? So that's going back to that unique, how am I, Jacqueline, living? That is that could possibly be contributing to some of that.
Wow, that just sounds like a result of a lot of crispy pata and adobo and like our Filipino diet is... That's a huge thing for us to at least reevaluate.
As a community, we should. We should reevaluate that, right? Like what I've noticed is that the more that I talk to my mom about these things, she just left, but her and my dad were here for a couple of weeks. And in that time, when she wanted to make all of these incredible, amazing, you know, home-cooked meals, and that is the way that my mom shows love, is to do it through cooking. And, you know, we talked about what kind of meat and we talked about like where she's getting some of the ingredients and should we choose organic versus not, you know, what is going into our sauces? Are there more natural alternatives? And that's really part of that discussion of just, you know, taking a step back and reevaluating that. And sometimes it's also taking a look at the carbs, taking a look at the pancit, taking a look at, you know, the rice and thinking about that. What role does that play in my body? How does my body feel when I eat these foods? So, you know, it's part of that discussion of also just educating my family and collaborating on how we can make these meals still feel nourishing, but in a healthier way than it may have been traditionally. And luckily, my mom was very much open to that, especially since she's also, you know, on her own healing journey. And it made for like a better experience, even when we were sitting down and talking about the food. It also gave us an opportunity to say, wow, you know, you're able to still cook certain dishes and still like have a really good taste profile, but we may have changed up the ingredients just a little bit to support better health. So, yeah.
That actually answers our next question, which was, given our Filipino diet and lifestyle, what sort of changes can we make? So that's perfect. And on that same note, because we are a health and wellness podcast, we do also like to typically ask our guests about their own health and wellness routines or self-care practices, like how I know what that consists of. So how do you find balance in being, you know, both a new mom and a lead physician at Love Life? You know, what do you sort of do to reset and practice self-care? And, you know, we'd love to know more about your personal wellness routine.
Yeah, you know, I have to set boundaries and time management is very important because I wish I had more time. I wish I had more time in the work that I do because I love it, but I also wish I had more time to spend at home with my son and my husband. And so setting very clear boundaries between work and also home life, it was a really important step for me. In the past, that version of Jacqueline who was, you know, concierge doctor in her early 30s, would say yes, 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 yes to everything, would be working around the clock, would be having her laptop open at 10 p.m. at night, finishing work, would, you know, burn through lunch and not stop, would not take a walk outside, and et cetera, et cetera, right? All the things. So I had to set boundaries. I have to manage my time well. I have to make sure that I leave work at work and that I'm not checking my work email frequently every single, you know, moment when I'm not there and on the weekends and responding to messages. I also think for me, the transition into work and out of work, that therapeutic practice, marking that you know, we think about from a meditation and a breathwork standpoint, really important step. When before I go to work and like right when I'm literally turning off the car and about to walk in, I take a beat to just focus on my breath work, remind myself of my purpose, remind myself of what I'm here to do. And just a few minutes, it doesn't have to be long, but just a few minutes between your work life and your home life helps to center you and put you in a space of purpose. And same thing happens when I leave to go home. The minute that I park, I also stop. And before I hurriedly rush and get all my stuff and go in the house, I also take a step back to leave work at work and remind myself that I am here to spend time with my family, to focus on my own self-care, to focus on my newborn son. And it also helps to ground you and center you just to really, like, again, focus on what that purpose is for that amount of time that you're spending. Before you go to bed, same thing. You know, our minds are always racing, but if you tap into, you know, focusing on what I'm trying to accomplish with my sleep, I want to support healing. I want to support my own healing journey from cancer to continue to kind of keep that at bay. What am I doing in terms of relaxing my body, focusing on deep rest and sleep? Like I oftentimes like use that as a way to help calm myself down so that my nervous system feels that calm, peace, and safety that we talked about earlier. But those transitions into work life and home life can really support making sure that you set those boundaries so that when I'm at work, I'm all in. And when I'm at home, same, I'm all in and just focused on myself, my family, et cetera.
That's awesome. I love that.
Okay. Cheryl here. As we begin to close, how can our community reach you if they have additional questions and tell us more about Love Life, who we are now lead physician for?
Yeah. You can find me on Instagram. So at Dr. Jacqueline Tolentino. I share a lot about my personal life there and my story, and, you know, things pop up even on Insta stories. As a physician, what I find really fun about it is that it's an opportunity to let people know more about who I am as a person and not just the fact that I practice medicine. So I do share a lot of wellness tips. I share, you know, bits and pieces of my story, my journey, my life, things that come up, different types of free events and educational offerings, ways to, you know, read summaries or read things that I write for other publications. It helps kind of like tap into how I think. So I do love to share a lot on there. My website, Dr. Jacqueline Tolentino, is also there as well. And then, of course, I work for Love Life. So I feel like we kind of like mentioned it a little bit, but what we do at Love Life is we've created this immersive health experience, and we've combined functional medicine, integrative health, cutting edge fitness and recovery modalities, you know, advanced diagnostics and precision testing, and nourishing food. And we provide all of that under one roof. So really our goal is to make sure that we've been addressing every dimension of health, mind, body, spirit, all in one place. So people can consider it more of like a home base for healing and wellness. What I love about that is that our memberships are tailored to longevity, to health and healing, to optimizing your body in whatever way your goals are. And the expert care team that our teams have typically combine myself, an integrative doctor. They also combine registered dietitian, maybe a health coach, traditional Chinese medicine doctor, an energetic practitioner, behavioral health who supports somatic healing, as well as a physical therapist and a trainer. So now all of the clinicians are all working together instead of being siloed into separate locations and separate places. So we're really trying to honor this experience of bringing medicine holistically together to support healing and honoring every different modality that is out there. So I'm excited to share that. And, you know, you're always welcome to come to our space. And I can't wait to see you all in person sometime here in Los Angeles. Our practice is 45,000 square feet. It is located in El Segundo. And it does have a restaurant on site that anybody can come to. There are services that are also available to the public, including spa. And also if people want a day pass to take a tour, that is offered complimentary, like a single day pass to check out the space. The Instagram and website, Love Life. So at the official Love Life, you know, we can always link it in the chat in case people want to learn more about it. There's also community offerings that we'll be having in the new year. So this also includes free education that's dedicated to all things health and wellness, which includes the Eastern practitioners, includes functional integrative medicine. So we can't wait to share that. So these are going to be some free community offerings that we'll offer at Love Life. We have an educational room that really houses about maybe 50 people or so, but it's an opportunity for everyone to come to our space and learn more about their bodies.
Yeah, please share those offerings with us, Dr. Jacqueline, as we move forward so we can make sure to tag all you and share them with our community.
I will.
And we are going to have to invite you back for a Q&A session. And I know there's so much more that we wanted to talk about related to hormonal health. We barely, you know, touched on, we didn't talk about thyroid. We didn't talk, you know, we barely touched on like diabetes, and there's like so much more even in the perimenopausal, menopausal arena. So we are going to have to figure out when to make that happen. But before...
Let's do it.
Yeah, let's figure that out. Let's get on the calendar. So before we close, are there any final words that you would want to share with our community throughout the diaspora to know when it comes to hormonal health?
Yeah. You know, stay curious. Be curious about your body. You know, allow yourself to learn as much as you can, to trust your gut, to advocate for yourself, to talk to your practitioners, to do inventory like we talk about, where you pay attention to what your goals are for your body and your health, that you're looking at what your symptoms are, getting those screenings done, the tests that you think you should, you know, making sure that your blood work is also checked so that we can also address those things. But stay curious, because a lot of times I see people put into this position where maybe they're dismissed by the doctor, or they only checked a couple of things and they still have questions. You're still curious. Maybe you have a ton of symptoms and maybe only one or two things was addressed, but you still want to know why. And that curiosity shows that you care about your health. It shows that you want to learn more. It shows that you're invested in your own well-being and also for everybody else that you care for. So stay curious, you know, advocate for yourself and ask those questions. And if you're looking for more resources, ask, right? Like, we're all here to share resources, even amongst this group and amongst those that are in the audience that are listening. So if you're looking for that, we're always here to support that. And same, so am I.
So awesome. So awesome. Yeah, Dr. Jacqueline Tolentino, thank you so much for your time, for your knowledge, your expertise, and sharing that with us, and talking about your practice and then hormonal health and why it's so important. Definitely look forward to witnessing your journey as it unfolds, and offer support in any way that we can to help put that word out for you. We will continue to help share your upcoming opportunities as we stay connected in partnership. We also will ask our IG, our community on IG, if anyone is interested in a follow-up Q&A session with you and with any other questions related to hormonal health that we hope to put together for our global audience. And to our community, for our next episode in the new year, we will be talking with educator Dr. Steph Carriaga about critical embodied wellness for educators. So stay tuned, as this episode will air on Wellness Wednesday, January 15th.
And as we close, we'd like to acknowledge once again our guest speaker, Dr. Jacqueline Tolentino, our graphic designer and producer for our opening and closing track, Richie, our advisors, Allison De La Cruz, Rian De Los Reyes, and Safa Teliogo, our community partners, SoCal Filipinos, the Filipino American Life, Rising Filipinas, Therapinay, and all of our community members for your share and support. And as always, we'll share more about our guest offerings on our IG stories and highlights for permanent access with any of the upcoming events. Be sure to follow us on Philippine X and Wellness on IG, Threads, Facebook, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, of course. Don't forget to continue to hit like and subscribe to our Philippine X and Wellness YouTube channel. And thank you for believing in us.
Be well, everyone. Continue to take care of yourself and each other.
Madamugin na nga salamat. Okay.